It is Thursday, August 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, North Korea says it's finalizing test missile launches aimed toward Guam. We get reaction from Guam's governor.
And I think for the people of Guam, every threat is taken seriously.
The FBI raids the home of President Donald Trump's former campaign manager, and a new opera based on the life of Apple founder Steve Jobs premieres in Santa Fe. It's all ahead. North Korea said Thursday it's finalizing a plan to launch four ballistic missiles off the shores of the U.S. territory of Guam. The reclusive communist state said that within a week, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un would be handed a plan to fire the Hwasong-12 missiles over Japan into the waters off Guam, 3,300 kilometers to the south. State media said the missiles would land 30 to 40 kilometers off the shores of Guam, where 163,000 people live, and the U.S. has 7,000 military personnel at a naval installation and an airbase. General Kim Rak-wom, the commander of the North Strategic Rocket Forces, told the state-run KCNA news agency that after the plan is given to Kim, the military would wait for his order. So what does Guam have to say about the latest provocations? International Edition's Philip Alexio spoke to the governor of Guam, Eddie Baza Calvo, who says the island is not panicking and is ready for anything.
I think for my administration, I think for the people of Guam, every threat is taken seriously. This is like the third or fourth since 2013. And so with that, there is worry, there is concern, but there is not panic. Things have changed since 2013 as we are looking at reports in the media. But then at the same time, also the government of Guam, our civil administration, together with our local Joint Region Marianas, the military command, and also in discussions with Washington, with the White House and NSA, we feel very confident in the ability to protect the island of Guam. So with that, it's important to give reassurance to the people of Guam that they must, conduct business every day as if it's an any other normal day. We get 10,000 to 15,000 tourists a day in from places such as Japan, places such as Korea, Taiwan, and China. We encourage the tourists to come on in as well. But at the same time, we're hopeful the decisions are moving forward, that cool heads will prevail, and we will not see any increase in terms of tension and ultimately hostility. So this island and its people have gone through war. We believe it is a horror. But then at the same time, it's important, and I think that's been very important for our administration since 2013, to separate what the rhetoric that is occurring, and a lot of it through the media, and through folks that are in positions of power, but get to the details of really what are the facts on the ground. What is the situation in regards to increasing of military movements in North Korea, as well as what is occurring on the ground in Guam? And I can tell you, after being briefed many times since 2013, as the civil government worked more closely in coordination with the United States military, is that there is, I would say, a very strong, formal, organized system in place for any type of ramp up in terms of some sort of action, and as well as the defensive umbrella that is a part of the United States and its allies system in this part of the world. And I talk about defense assets in Korea and Japan, defense assets in the Western Pacific, and the defense assets that we have also in Guam. So I feel very confident that our people are protected. And at the same time, we're hopeful that things will de-escalate. And we're also hoping that our leadership in Washington can work with our allies in Japan and South Korea and bring in those vested interests, such as China. It's to China's best interest that this thing calms down. Because, the direction that the North Korean leader is moving towards, there obviously is not the right direction. And aside from the United States, I think Japan and South Korea will also, if he continues this way, move in a direction that they believe is important for their safety and security as well.
And, Governor, what are your thoughts about the way the president has responded to North Korea?
As an American governor in Ground Zero and a Chamorro Guamanian that has lived his life here in Guam, if Guam or Honolulu or Los Angeles is threatened with an attack, it is my hope that a U.S. president will be very clear in his message to potential adversaries that it will be met with overwhelming force. And whether it's hell or fury or brimstone. So that is not my, you know, my concern.
Guam Governor Eddie Bazzacalvo speaking with International Edition's Philip Alexio. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's happening?
You know, I just have to say, I can't remember a time when I've heard so much talk of fire and brimstone and other kinds of things in news, in solid international foreign affairs and news. It just kind of took me aback there. Well, the North Korea story is obviously on many people's minds, and people are sharing their opinions on it as social media encourages one to do. One of the popular hashtags these days is just hashtag NOKOR, N-O-K-O-R, which is just kind of a shortening down of North Korea. And believe me, people are sharing their opinions all around. It's not just right or left or pro-Trump, anti-Trump, or whatnot. I'm just going to go through a few of these and then just kind of take a look at the broader trends. Here's somebody goes by the name Keegan Salick, quoting Trump, quote, hashtag NOKOR will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. Keegan adding this isn't a movie, you moron. Yodasek writes this, what the hell is wrong with North Korea? Why are they threatening Guam again? And where the heck is Guam? Well, I think we know now. Arthur Gacy, NOKOR planning to attack Guam? ? It will not happen. Why tell the world of an attack plan? North Korean hashtag NOKOR obsolete generals are senile. There's also been some criticism of not just Mr. Trump, but some other politicians here in the United States. You may remember that Jill Stein, she ran for president in 2016 under the aegis of the Green Party.
Yes.
And she has come out recently sort of, I wouldn't say defending North Korea, but saying, you know, the North Koreans have a point in that they feel threatened by the United States, and their only means of protecting themselves, they feel, is to have a nuclear weapon. And a lot of people not happy about that. Here's Pete De Leon. Does Jill Stein, understand that hundreds of thousands of people could die, including Americans, in a conflict with hashtag NOKOR, and that she is siding with them? A number of other people stepping forward and, you know, calling her everything basically short of treasonous. So lots of concern, lots of opinion out there. And I expect that will continue for some time.
I think you're right about that. Even during August, usually a slow,
exactly.
Slow time of the year. All right. Thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that we are following. Kenya's Electoral Commission says they are now in the final stretch. The EEOC finds reasonable cause that Cargill violated the rights of Somali American Muslim workers. A new wave of media arrests takes place in Turkey, and a freed Russian activist calls for a boycott of presidential elections. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The World Health Organization says the rise of antibiotic-resistant infections has become a threat to public health. As microbes continue to develop mutations and render previously effective medications useless, scientists are developing new methods of treatment to fight these so-called superbugs. Amino acid compounds called antimicrobial peptides, or AMPs, could someday become alternatives to today's antibiotics. A new study in the journal Chemical Biology outlines work by scientists who say they improve both the antimicrobial and anti-cancer properties of an amp called gomycin that was taken from a Brazilian spider. The researchers made several varieties of the gomycin amp, and they found some were 10 times more effective at killing bacteria than those made in past experiments. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Apple founder Steve Jobs had a dramatic life, and it's now the subject of an opera. U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation agents raided the home of President Donald Trump's former campaign chief in the pre-dawn hours late last month, intensifying their probe of Russian interference in last year's presidential election. The raid on the home of Paul Manafort occurred just outside Washington in suburban Virginia and without warning. Aides to the 68-year-old Manafort confirmed Wednesday that federal agents executed a search warrant on July 26, seizing documents and other materials. The raid came just hours after Manafort had met voluntarily with the Senate Intelligence Committee, one of several congressional panels investigating possible collusion between Trump campaign officials and Russian officials aimed at helping Trump win last November's election. Bobby Chacon is a retired special agent with the FBI. I asked him about the raid on Manafort's home.
The interesting part that jumped out to me from the report in the Washington Post was that this raid took place one day after Manafort met with investigators from the Senate Intelligence Committee. So now, and I'm speculating here, but there could have been something coming out of that meeting with those investigators if they spoke to the FBI, which they would have, that prompted the FBI to quickly do a search like that. You know, in this day and age where, you know, emails can be destroyed, and we learned that through the Hillary Clinton investigation. So, you know, the FBI is very aware that they want to, where in the past, if in this type of investigation, you would have given people the chance to produce documents voluntarily or via subpoena. Now it's different now because things can be destroyed. We've learned that. And so, you know, the timing of this one day after he met with Senate Intelligence Committee members or investigators could be telling. It might mean nothing, but to me, that's something that kind of piqued my interest when I read that part of the story. So the FBI would simply do this to preserve evidence that you know, obviously could be destroyed. And so, you know, we want to do these things to preserve. Now, he was under a subpoena and he was producing documents pursuant to those subpoenas, you know, but if the FBI, through whatever reason, felt that he wasn't producing all the documents relevant, you know, under subpoena, you know, they may have gone in to seize things before they thought they might be destroyed.
Well, now, this investigation has been continuing, and has been examined as far as his involvement, possible involvement, links to the Russians. Does this seem that he's looked on now as a central figure in this investigation?
Well, you know, he's been investigated, I think, as far back as 2014 about his lobbying efforts on behalf of the Ukrainian government and officials there. Now, this new investigation into the Trump campaign, of course, he was the campaign manager, particularly at the time when the Donald Trump Jr. and Kushner meeting took place, you know, with that Russian lawyer. And I believe Manafort was actually present at that meeting. So, you know, sure, he is a central figure, you know, in this investigation, not only the investigation that went back to 2014, but even this new investigation from 2016 and the collusion investigation, you know, as the campaign manager and as someone who was present at that meeting that everybody seems to want to know about, sure, he would be a central figure in this investigation.
How close does this investigation seem to be getting to the White House?
Well, I mean, when you have, you know, the campaign manager of the presidential campaign, it's certainly, you know, very close to candidate Trump. Now, I don't know, you know, the question becomes, you know, one of behavior, right? Of either criminal behavior or not, when the behavior took place. And it could be, you know, was this, you know, most of it took place during the campaign when they were working for, you know, candidate Trump. Obviously, Manafort was let go during the campaign, I believe, prior to the election. And so, you know, I don't know how much of this extends to the actual White House after inauguration. You could have, you know, attempts at covering things up that where the criminality may have occurred prior to the election, but the cover up continued after the election. And again, this is all speculation. I don't know that there was any criminality. The investigators, you know, the grand jury and Mr. Mueller's team will determine that, and I have full confidence in them. But if it happened, then, you know, then you've got, you know, possible cover-up activity in the White House.
Bobby Chacon, a retired special agent with the FBI, he spoke to me from Los Angeles. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Steve Jobs, who helped usher in the era of personal computers, has been the subject of movies and books, but his complicated life and the ubiquitous objects he left behind also turn out to be the stuff of opera. 10 years after Apple released its first smartphone, the story of the creative genius behind the company premiered at the Santa Fe Opera. Naomi Lewin reports on the revolution of Steve Jobs.
Mark Campbell, one of the most prolific librettists in contemporary American opera, was not sure at first that writing an opera about Steve Jobs was a good idea.
I've had a number of socialist friends of mine saying, "Why would you write an opera about Steve Jobs? He was the worst capitalist." And I'll say, "Reach in your pocket, you probably have an iPhone there."
Tap, set a date. Tap, set a date. Tap.
But composer Mason Bates was convinced he'd found the right subject for his first opera.
Steve Jobs' life was complicated and messy. He had a daughter that he didn't acknowledge for many years. He had cancer. You can't control that. He was, while a very charismatic figure, quite a hard-driving boss. And his collisions with the fact that he wanted to make everything sleek and controllable, yet life is not controllable, is a fascinating topic for an opera.
Rather than creating a chronological life story, Campbell says the collaborators opted for a fragmented narrative to reflect the man and his machines.
Steve Jobs did have a mind that just jumped from idea to idea to idea. It was very quick. And we wanted to tell an opera that is also very quick, that jumps around.
The revolution of Steve Jobs shifts back and forth in time over the course of 18 scenes, and Bates created a different musical world for each character. Since Jobs played guitar and spent much of his time dealing with electronics,
Steve Jobs has this kind of busy, frenetic, quicksilver world of acoustic guitar and electronica.
Jobs' wife, Laureen, had a calming influence, helping him focus, and her sound reflects that.
Completely different space of these kind of oceanic, soulful strings.
Not that again, not the right time.
Other characters depicted include Jobs' partner, Steve Wozniak, and the Japanese-born Zen priest Kobunchino Otogawa, who led Jobs to convert to Buddhism and served as a mentor for much of his life.
Kobun, the spiritual advisor, has an almost purely electronic world of prayer bowls and process Thai gongs.
The opera's set echoes Jobs' creations, says director Kevin Newberry. After a prologue and a replica of the iconic garage where Jobs' ideas first took shape, the garage walls explode into six moving cubes with screens, which look a lot like iPhones.
We're doing something called projection mapping, where all of the scenic units have little sensors so the video actually moves with them. We wanted to integrate it so seamlessly into the design, because that's what Steve Jobs and Apple did with the products themselves.
Jobs' sense of design was enormously influenced by Japanese calligraphy, including the Enso, a circle that depicts the mind being free to let the body create. Bates says that also figures in the opera's title, The Revolution of Steve Jobs, with the capital R in parentheses.
Of course, there's the revolution of Steve Jobs in his creations and his devices. There's also the evolution from a countercultural hippie to a mogul of the world's most valuable company. And there's the revolution in a circle of Steve Jobs as he looks at the Enso, this piece of Japanese calligraphy, and finds that when he can kind of come full circle, he reaches the kind of completion that he sought so long in his life.
A life marked by a struggle to find the balance between human imperfections and the drive to create the perfect thing. Audiences have been wildly enthusiastic, even if critical reaction to the opera has been mixed. Now it's headed to Seattle, home to rival tech company Microsoft, and then to San Francisco, which will bring the piece full circle to the Bay Area where Steve Jobs grew up. For VOA News, I'm Naomi Lewin.
And that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States congratulates the people of Rwanda on their active and peaceful participation in the presidential election held August 4th. More than 6.6 million Rwandans cast ballots for Mr. Kagame, according to the official tally, though this number appears inflated. Just over 80,000 voted for the opposition. The government claimed turnout totaled 97.6%. But the electoral process fell short of democratic standards. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said, "We are disturbed by irregularities observed during voting and reiterate longstanding concerns over the integrity of the vote tabulation process." The United States commends the Rwandan media for reporting on complaints of harassment of some opposition candidates and Rwandan citizens during the campaign. The U.S. also commends average citizens, the National Electoral Commission, and government officials for speaking out and addressing those complaints. Spokesperson Nauert added, "We applaud the televised presidential debate," while noting that voters' understanding would have benefited from broader participation of the candidates themselves. The U.S. remains concerned by the lack of transparency in determining the eligibility of prospective candidates. It is hoped the new electoral law to be debated in the next session of Parliament will clarify that process well before the 2018 parliamentary elections. Rwandan President Kagame has led the country of 12 million people since his rebels helped to end the 1994 genocide in which more than 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus were massacred by Hutu extremists. Under President Kagame, Rwanda has made great economic strides, but his critics say this has come at the expense of civil liberties and media freedoms. Human rights groups report that his government has used state powers to silence the opposition through systematic repression. A constitutional amendment in 2015 allows Mr. Kagame to stay in power until 2034 if he pursues it. The United States expressed disappointment with the change to the Constitution and Kagame's decision to seek a third term. The United States encourages the government of Rwanda to foster an environment where civil society and all political parties can participate in elections without intimidation and elections truly reflect the will of the people. The United States stands by the people of Rwanda in their efforts to build strong, democratic, and inclusive institutions in order to ensure long-term stability and a democratic, prosperous future for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.